you're considering a lot of learning styles. The public spaces, that's required, but it's under different provisions in the sense that your child is, in some cases, they're sought out, they're identified, a structure and plan is set up with the parent included, a whole way of, you know, making some decisions about what that plan is going to entail and how it will be implemented. In the higher education space, you have to self-disclose.
Hello, and welcome to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast with Winifred A. Winston and LaDerek Horn, the show that unapologetically focuses on helping Black and underrepresented minorities navigate the special education process. We want to help raise awareness in the Black and Brown community, remove the stigma about learning disabilities, and provide you access to professionals in the space of dyslexia and special education that you need to hear from.
Today, we're going to be talking about accommodations in college and the workplace. I have with me Dr. Allison Butler. She is the Director of Accessibility Services, and she's also the ADA Compliance Officer in Higher Education. And I'm not going to be coy about it. I know Allison. We worked together about 6 years ago. I was Associate Director of Career Services, and she was the Director of Accessibility Services. So she's been doing this work for a long time. So I am so excited to have you, Allison. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Winifred. I'm so happy and just overjoyed with everything that you've been doing in this work. We really need your voice, and I'm just glad that I could partner in this way.
Yeah, I'm so excited. And also, Allison is on our Business Development Committee for Dyslexia Advocation. So we are made up of good stock in this space because there is a lot of work that needs to be done. So Allison, tell me, what do you do? And just give us a little snippet of accessibility services and the work around ADA compliance before we dig deep so the audience will understand how important and what this work means to folks who have learning disabilities.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Overall, in my role, I manage like the daily functions and activities around providing accommodations in like the different spaces around campus. So for instance, if we're thinking about the classroom, there's specific academic accommodations. If there's housing involved, there's specific housing needs. If we're thinking about library, there's certain things that, you know, the library has to consider in navigating accessibility to all. And we also provide accommodations in the workplace as well for employees. So we're a federally mandated office. So ADA stands for Americans with Disabilities Act, which was passed in 1990. And Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. And what that means is that any institution that receives any federal dollars has to provide services to ensure inclusion of anyone with a disability. So our offices exist at every college in the United States. So know that there's some form or representation, depending on the size of the institution, you'll see larger offices. At smaller institutions, I've seen a one-person shop. So it's going to look a lot different. Also, the way that accommodations are managed and implemented really depends on how the institution is set up. And leadership really factors into that. Having support and the funds to, you know, make sure that you're staying on par with like best practices. There's a professional association that we join, which is called AHEAD. That's the Association for Higher Education and Disability. And that really is a forum for us to, they have conferences, they host webinars. We talk through this work. There's regional boards that actually engage in professional development around this work. And so it's an active process in making sure that we are staying up to par with what is considered best for inclusion, access, and equity.
Wow. And you just dropped a lot. I just want to chime in because when you said ADA in 1990, I'm like, wait a minute, that wasn't very long ago because I was in high school. I was like 1990. And then I want to make it clear, You just said every college or university, every institution that receives federal dollars has some form, some type of services. So I want you guys to hear that. I want parents to hear that. So every college and university that receives federal dollars, they must provide reasonable accommodations. Mm-hmm. Right. So I want parents to hear that. And when you said that professional organization, you said AHED, is that AHED?
Mm-hmm. EAD.
EAD.
Association for Higher Education and Disability.
Ah, okay. Okay.
But that's the professional organization our offices, a lot of them belong to, hold professional membership, and it gives us access to a lot of different forms of engagement with nationally. Like, there's a lot of institutions that are doing a lot of great work in the area of inclusion expansively, because a lot of times when we think about disability, it's like the last thing that we're considering as like identity space when we think about diversity efforts.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you talk a little more about, I always reference the K&W Guide to Colleges for Students with Learning Differences. Mm-hmm. And so I always tell parents there are three types of services. You've got your structured programs, which are the most comprehensive. Mm-hmm. And I believe you have to sign a contract. It's probably more like a program, mm-hmm. right? And then we have coordinated services where there's at least one staff member or someone certified, and you have to voluntarily request opt-in, mm-hmm. you know. And then we have services, schools that just provide services, which is the least comprehensive. Can you talk about the difference in those programs and what that might look like?
Yes. So some institutions actually receive endowment funds, scholarship funds, certain things that are designated to specific disability efforts. And so, for instance, some universities may have like a learning disorders clinic specifically on campus. Sometimes sometimes departments of psychology might have a specific unit that manages psychoeducational assessments, and that's they work with supervised clinical rotation for like their doctoral students. Wow. Those are like some of the types of structured, you know, types of services, and that's the reason why they exist. You know, like our offices, we have specific operational funding from the university, so mm-hmm. whatever budgets and things like that. But sometimes it's like endowments, specific interests of like a leadership group, you know, a leadership at that time, and focusing on a specific trend that they're seeing. Or University of Washington's a great example. So they actually have the Disabilities Opportunities, Inner Networking and Technology. And they provide a lot of resources for educators, students. They also, it's based under, you know, University of Washington, but they also have a lot of public scope, and they do a lot of work, you know, in representing best practices in like these specific areas as it relates to higher education.
Oh, that is awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. So that's an example of what a structured program might look like at a university, because mm-hmm. essentially they're using their internal, I would say their internal workings, because of the programs that they offer. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. then you may have, like you said, these endowments or funds that or scholarship funds that mm-hmm. are specific to a particular area, because more than likely someone had it and they mm-hmm. have the money.
Right.
And they
may have a student that graduated and utilized specific services. So, you know, that's like a gift to the institution.
Sure.
And so like sometimes you'll see like a lot of universities have centers for autism, like I said earlier, learning disorders, like specialists. Some universities have an academic support centers that are available for all. And that's a really good approach as well. Some actually have specific academic coaching that is, sometimes it's tailored to all, or it's tailored to specific learning disabilities.
Okay.
So those are all things that, you know, factor into good decisions for, you know, the best fit for any child.
Yeah. I think we even talked about the 30 best colleges for students with learning differences.
Absolutely.
That's a resource, and we'll definitely have that in the show notes so parents can check that out. And then talk about, because I know when we worked together, we worked at a university that was online. Mm-hmm. And like I said, this was like 6-7 years ago, right?
Right, right.
And now look how relevant that is post-pandemic. Oh, I can't Absolutely. Even say post-pandemic, because you know what? I still have a lot of anxiety about going out.
I know. I'm very slow with it. I am.
And being around people, you know?
Right, right, right.
But I watch my daughter. She is 11. I watch her during this pandemic. Her school sent her home to do virtual. Mm-hmm. And then they went back in person. But now I look at her, get on Zoom, and she's 11. And I look at her, oh, mommy, I just pulled the arrow down and the number was already there. And, you know, and the other day she clicked, but she was moving too fast because she wanted to use the speech to text to look up mm-hmm, something.
Right.
I was just watching, like, look at her go. Like, she just was getting it.
Yeah.
You know, and so talk about some of the accommodations for online learning, because that mm-hmm. is huge right now. We know
Definitely.
That a lot of folks have been successful with it, but a lot have not. But I don't think parents really know what help to ask for.
Right,
because
right.
This is really new territory now.
Right, right. The thing that's interesting, like you even mentioned, the technology space really creates so many opportunities for access, and then it creates barriers for others. Mm-hmm. And so it shifts, you know, outside of like the traditional classroom, depending on how classes are set up. I think the one thing I do appreciate at the institution that we worked for was that they actually had instructional designers that still exist, you know, they're still mm-hmm. in place today. And so they sometimes, like, institutions really need to make decisions about who has ownership of accessibility and the, like, their wheelhouse. So for instance, for faculty, at a higher ed institution, they're not trained in like special education or like in a lot of things in teacher education. Sometimes they're talking about inclusive design, universal design, because in the public school spaces, you have to ensure that like you are providing, you're setting up your classroom and considering usability as it exists. You're considering a lot of learning styles. The public spaces, that's required, but it's under different provisions in the sense that your child is, in some cases, they're sought out, they're identified, a structure and plan is set up with the parent included, a whole way of, you know, making some decisions about what that plan is going to entail and how it will be implemented. In the higher education space, you have to self-disclose, just sharing some of the things that, you know, you've been able to learn. You have to self-identify. But the great thing is, like, in the online settings is that they have, depending on how the programs are set up. So for instance, the institution that we work for, they didn't have timed exams by the time I started there. They removed that as part of their curriculum. They found that it wasn't necessarily important to grasp, you know, an understanding of the material to be able to show and demonstrate, you know, the learning, you know, in that type of environment. And plus they serve, you know, a lot of non-traditional students. So, you know, and part of that understanding, they're thinking ahead, you know, in some ways about removing a barrier, even though, you know, it serves individuals with disabilities, but that it is, serves all.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Allison, that's so huge. The time exam, because, oh, sorry. I'm always revealing that I only recently found out that I have ADHD. And I follow some folks on Instagram and they make these jokes about ADHD. And so one of the jokes recently was, here's the ADHD brain when you have a timed exam, right? And so you're like, oh, wow, I have 1 hour. Oh my gosh, I'm gonna have 1 hour to take this exam. Oh my gosh. And I'm reading the question and it was making a joke. And it was like, and now I've wasted 2 minutes because your anxiety mm-hmm. is just so high, mm-hmm. right? And because you're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And people don't understand that ADHD brain, that's what it's thinking about. I have right. all this time and then right. all this anxiety. And it was so profound because I had just taken the state exam, a state exam recently to earn licensure. And that was me. And I took my medicine that day. But when I sat down and I saw that timer, it's like it automatically did something to my brain. And I was like, okay, don't focus on the time. Don't focus on the time. But I was focused on the time and I wasted like 3 minutes because I was focused on the time.
Yeah. And that's why exam accommodations exist. And it's unfortunate because you never got a chance to, you know, identify, you know, because you didn't know.
No.
And so that's what's unfortunate, because when we do extended time as an accommodation, those are the reasons for that. So there's a lot of different reasons it's needed, you know, depending on the nature of the disability, but specifically for ADHD, like if you had time and a half, at least you know you have an hour to complete the exam, but you still have like another 30 minutes to deal with what you have to compensate for, you know, that your peers don't. You know, they don't have that same experience. So, you know, an hour, they're able to, you know, get it done. They don't have to go through that anxiety and, you know, that pressure, you know, that happens. Yep. So anyway, that's a great example of why exam accommodations exist. But I mean, all online institutions don't do that. That is like a strategic move, you know, for, you know, a programmatic decision, you know, but there's a lot of reasons that timed exams exist, you know, and depending on the type of programs, because that depending on the, you know, at online institutions, you know, not every program can be done online. You can't get your medical degree online.
No, no.
There's just no, absolutely no way. So certain programs, you know, you're able to, a lot of times they might have open enrollment, so you don't have to go through like a specific standardized test to get in. So that's another reason some students with disabilities might find that to be a better environment for them. Some students that are really good at self-pacing themselves, they will thrive in that type of environment. Our non-traditional students, like in any type of form, whether you're a military veteran, whether you're a single mother, whether, you know, you're working, you know, multiple jobs, sometimes the online spaces are better. And there are accommodations there, but it really depends on how the courses are set up. So for instance, flexibility with deadlines is something that's requested depending on the, you know, if it's a reasonable fit. And the challenge with that is that there does become a time where you can't, you know, continue to extend a deadline. Mm-hmm. And so there's certain things like, you know, if you negotiate like a day or two, that's one thing. But if you try to go beyond like maybe, I don't know, 5 or 7 days, there's other things that might need to be discussed because you're automatically put behind. And then it's just going to increase the anxiety and trigger a lot of things, because some individuals with chronic health conditions might need that. Sometimes some students with mental health conditions, as well as maybe ADHD, you know.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot of different reasons that that accommodation exists, but it can be challenging. And I think the one thing that's different from high school to college is that you don't have your parents kind of telling you and, you know, kind of guiding you of like, you know, just reminding you of the steps that you need to do.
And that's why self-advocacy is so important, you know, in public schools, especially for Black and Brown kids. They aren't encouraged. They aren't taught to embrace it and wear it as a badge of honor, right? And I talk about this a lot. I taught in the public school system here, mostly Black and Brown children, and nobody wanted to admit they had an IEP except for when it was time to get a job. And then when I worked in the more affluent, predominantly white institution over the summer, those high school kids were raising their hands. They were telling me that they took their medication, like, they were accessing resources. And the program that I was teaching in, we took them on college tours every Friday to say, okay, this is how you would, this is the office you would request accommodations. These are the type of accommodations.
Right.
And Black students don't do that. I have parents reach out to me, oh, my child is struggling. He can't pass this math class. And I'm like, well, did he have an IEP in K-12? Oh, yeah, but we're not going to use that. I'm like, no, that's not how it works.
Right.
You know, and
the thing is, and the exact same thing. And, you know, another layer to that is, you know, we're a beautiful and colorful diaspora, but some of us come from different countries. And so the Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, special education didn't exist overseas. Mm-hmm. And then also for us as Black Americans, though, you know, for us, Black and Brown, we just don't seek out. I mean, we're a prideful culture. We have not, and we've been taught to distrust certain services. And there is some truth about the labels and, like, you know, how it can follow you. And, you know, there is not always the best experience. So sometimes it's, you know, been, you know, some, in some experiences, they've just been like, no, I don't, you know, I don't want to disclose. But the great thing now is that the focus in special education is inclusion. So it's not about, there might be certain things that your child might need to be separate to do and manage and things like that, like maybe speech therapy or, you know, what, you know, depending on what other services are offered. But most of the class are immersed with the, you know, all the students. And so it makes, it's preparing them, you know, to be like, you know, depending on where they go.
Yeah. Navigate. And see, in K-12, you have the IEP. Okay. But once you leave high school, nobody's gonna know.
You have to self-disclose.
And it makes me think back to when I was in graduate school, right? Let me tell you, and it was a predominantly white institution, PWI. I'll never, ever forget this. It was, I wanna say it was my training and development course because I really liked that teacher. I did my master's in HR and I was doing a presentation and I had two other people in my group. They were white. And I was planning a vacation trip. I think I was going to Vegas, actually. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So I was going to Vegas and we were working on this project and we had to do a presentation. So as a group, we assigned each other a section. Do you know at the last hour, I'd never forget, he's my friend on LinkedIn. He was like, oh, I can't write that. I have a learning disability. And, you know, I don't even know, remember what he told me he had, but he couldn't do it. Then she popped up and said the same thing, right? That she had a learning disability and she couldn't write. I'm like, I'm about to board the plane. Oh my gosh. And this assignment is due. So I had to do the whole assignment, right? And I'm like, are you kidding me? And, you know, of course, Logan wasn't born yet. I wasn't immersed in this environment, but I did do my internship in undergrad at with Special Olympics North Carolina. So I wasn't totally clueless but I thought, why did they wait till the last minute? But I'm even thinking, did my professor do that intentionally, right? Because I'm thinking like, how did I get in that group with two of them that told me that, but they were white, they disclosed, right? They were in the program, they were thriving. I ended up writing the whole report. And the only thing that pissed me off was I could tell when we presented that they did not read it. Because you still had to do your section. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
I could tell. And I'm looking like, and I never said anything to the professor because at the time I didn't know that in higher ed you had to self-disclose and she may have known. You know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't want to tell their business. But Allison, tell us about workplace accommodations, because what I see is, especially for Black and brown folks, they're not getting identified in K-12, or they are identified, but they're incorrectly identified. And if they are identified, they have an IEP, but it's not robust. They're not getting what they need. Right. They go to college. A lot of folks that I've spoken with, they were identified in college, right? They were able to cope and use some strategies in K-12. They identify in college, but then when they get in the workplace, they still don't know how to self-advocate, right? And in the workplace, a lot of folks just are not going to tell an employer that they need some assistance. No. I just start marking on every application, do you have a learning disability? A disability. It don't say learning. It says disability. Right. And it lists all these things.
Yeah, that's the EEO question.
Yep. And I mark yes now, right? Because I'm ADHD and I'm like, I've got to figure out what I might need. Because right now, although I know I'm ADHD, I know how it shows up.
I
still don't know what I might need at work. And so I mark yes, because I say, you know what, if I'm advocating and I'm instructing others to do it, I'm going to practice what I preach.
And
I mark yes. And so I remember having a ball chair at work. At the time, I didn't even know I was ADHD, but I think about how much it helped me. I sat on that exercise ball type of chair. It helped me because I fidget a lot. But that's when I'm thinking, right? I'm focused. I don't even know. I'm still learning, like, what might help me or what I need, because I don't quite know what to ask for. But I know sometimes I can feel overwhelmed with a lot of tasks. I work good with a lot of tasks, but I don't even know what to ask for to help me organize all those tasks.
Yeah, the workplace is very different. See, the thing is that depending on, you know, what your disability is. So if we're talking about ADHD, dyslexia, et cetera, a lot of times you need academic accommodations and they don't translate in the workplace because, you know, the workplace is a completely different environment. So there's a combination of ways that, like, you know, there might not be a specific accommodation that you're requesting, but there's things that you need to compensate for. So for instance, sometimes it's like finding first, because the thing is, you have to be, the thing is under the ADA, it's about reasonable accommodations. It's also, there's a caveat about you have to be eligible for the workplace or the program. So you have to meet the needs of the job description with or without accommodations. Mm-hmm. So for instance, bring an exercise ball in, you know, you can do that on your own, or your space might already be set up ergonomically that, you know, they incorporate certain things like that. So for instance, Google, I think we all heard about, I mean, you know, Google supposedly had the rock star workspaces. Like, you know, they offered a cafe, they offered like these different sitting rooms. You don't have necessarily, you know, some people might have an office space, but it's not the traditional office space, like they're shared spaces. Sometimes they're open spaces, open conference rooms, just different ways for people to engage, take breaks, you know, different work schedules. Like, you know, it's not like a rigid 9 to 5, like you can come in if you work best from 6 to 3, or if you work best from like 7 to 11 or something like that, or excuse me, 7 to 1 in the morning or something like that. Like, you know, they offer a lot of that with their spaces because of the way their approach is very innovative, and they know, like, there's certain types of fields that a lot of individuals with disabilities thrive in.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, you know, it's also about finding that match for you. So sometimes the reason why you don't necessarily know what to ask for is just because there's some things that you need to just do to self-compensate. So for instance, me with the calendar, with the way that my job is and what I have to manage, and I'm always being pulled in different directions, and I have to maintain my email, I have to do projects, I have to do meetings, you know, I have, everything is on the go. And so, like, for instance, like, you know, I live by my calendar. So if it's not on my calendar, like, you know, I have my personal calendar and work calendar, but I've been able to kind of manage that. And so I'm really good with organization and things like that. I used to do academic coaching and things, you know, things of that nature. So I'm really good with organization and, you know, time management and things like that, but I had to work at that. So, you know, some of it has to be like certain things that we're working towards and compensating for, but in the workplace, like a deadline, you know, you might not be able to push that back, but you might be able to, like, you know, the great example was the exercise ball. Either your employer could buy that for you, or you could just bring that.
Well, you know what, with that, I was at a special education school.
Yeah.
So that chair was already there. They said, oh, exactly. Well, do you want to use one or the other? I was like, oh, I'll take the exercise ball chair. Now I took it because I thought it was going to help me with my abs.
Right, right.
But then when I realized, like, when I'm giving tours and I'm learning about the school and everything, and one of the great things is we had different seating for the children, right? Right. And I'm like,
it's called ergonomic equipment.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I said, wait a minute. That's what I'm doing. Yeah. I'm sitting on this ball chair. And then hence I learned that I'm ADHD, and I'm like, wait a minute. And I remember rocking and not even knowing that I'm rocking on the chair.
Right.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is something. And I remember at another job, my supervisor, he had a standing desk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You never saw him sitting down.
Yeah.
And he had like an extra mat on the floor.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some type of equipment.
It's lumbar support.
Yes. Yes. So he has that.
And that's the thing about the work environment and the match. Because one of the things that I always really focus on is like the way that we can build in accessibility is called universal design. So we're making those decisions ahead of time. So if we have a workspace, like, you know, how are we making decisions about the type of furniture that we buy? You know what I mean? Because like the buying a standing desk and like some of those regular traditional, you know, heavy desk and things like that. I know it's changing that we get lighter equipment now, but getting the standing desk serves all because even you still can sit.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So like if people would prefer to sit, that's available to them. If you had circulation issues, that's a good fit for you. If you're just like, you know, a health nut, you know, that helps you, you know, keep focus. You know, sometimes it, you know, helps with like, you know, just the brain activity. And like some people have like treadmills, you know, underneath their, you know, doing their work. I saw that a lot in the pandemic. But yeah, if we build in ergonomics, that's a very inclusive approach for workplaces that minimizes the number of accommodation requests that are needed. So that's the strategy that, because the thing is the standing desk and like that traditional desk are pretty much about the same price if you buy it ahead of time. So make those decisions ahead of time for your, for this incoming, you know, we're intergenerational at this point. So we need to think about all for a lot of different reasons, including, you know, things that will serve, you know, our disability communities, things that serve us in a neurodiverse, you know, capacity, and thinking about the way that we process and think and come up with innovative types of, whether it's decision-making, whether it's a specific project, whether it's a program, just the way that we engage and do that. Like, you know, we're thinking about talent in a different way and accepting all these differences in ways that we haven't. That's what we should be working towards with inclusion.
Yeah. And you hit on a key thing. It doesn't cost much. It doesn't cost more.
If you do it ahead of time.
Yeah.
Do it from the beginning.
I think a lot of businesses, the first thing they think is cost.
Yeah.
And depending on how the business is structured, is it going to come out of my budget?
Right.
And they're thinking cost. And I know ADA compliance falls under HR. And, you know, historically, HR hasn't been a money generating department. Right. It's been very transactional. And we know that good HR departments, they show you the numbers, right? They show you what it costs to recruit. They show you what it costs, how much money we lose if we don't have strong retention numbers,
right?
How much it costs to backfill a position.
Right.
You know, and so we've got to be, as HR professionals, more savvy with saying, look at the cost of this if we do this now.
Absolutely.
Right. And
absolutely,
they've got to speak the language of the CFO. You got to talk money to them.
You do.
To get their attention to say, hey, we can do a better job.
Yeah. It's a great business practice.
Yeah.
It's the best business practice.
I think
the beautiful thing of the pandemic and this shift of how we're thinking about work is that, for instance, schedule can, you know, create barriers for some individuals with disabilities and what they're managing. So like, for instance, some people just naturally, you know how like back in the day when we had to figure out like our optimal concentration time, like some of us work better 9 a.m. and some of us are better later in the day. So, you know, if we're thinking about how that exists in the workspace, why does 9 to 5 have to be like you know, why is that the tradition? Now we can kind of think about hybrid ways of engaging in the workspaces. Now we can think about more teleworking opportunities and ways, you know, to be productive at home. And that is, you know, a way of thinking about inclusion. That's the beauty now too of, I'm glad you put it out there because, you know, as I said earlier, some of it is we have to find the best fit for us. Mm-hmm. So like, for instance, an accommodation isn't going to solve everything. So you can't go into a job. Nobody can go into a job thinking the accommodation is going to get you the schedule you want.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Sometimes it can, but it depends on what's built in, you know, already. And so you kind of are working around that and you're negotiating that. So, you know, there's a lot of things that go into determining what's reasonable, a reasonable workplace accommodation. But for instance, the big thing now is with people returning to work, there is an uptick of people requesting, you know, remote work as an accommodation, which, you know, is valid and can be substantiated. the challenge is that not everybody's going to be approved. So it really depends on the work environment. So for instance, if you are working in an environment that requires a lot more social interaction, like if you're required to work directly with students, if you are working with patient care, directly with patients, you're not going to be, you're not going to be approved for that, even if you request it. You know, even if you have a substantial valid reason, you're not going to be approved for that because of the work environment that you're in. And sometimes that can be, there's some, you know, it just depends on the corporation, institution, how their makeup, how large they are. Sometimes you might just have to look for another position, or sometimes they might have some options to like for a reassignment or certain things like that, but it's just not guaranteed. It just depends on how large the corporation or the, so some of it is about the best fit for you. So like, you know, then there's like another, let's say it's an IT role and you don't have to interface. Everything can be remote. So if you're asking for a remote in that setting, you probably would be honored.
I'm hoping as an accommodation that this pandemic will force some employers to step up their game with their technology. Because for example, when I was working before the pandemic, we were all sent home. The governor shut Maryland down within the second, I think, or third week of March. And within a week of us sending everybody home to work remotely, we had issues. We all couldn't get on a server.
Right.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, they're not even equipped to have us working from home. And then I talked to another friend of mine, and he's like, no, he worked for a larger institution. And he was like, no, we were doing those checks annually and sometimes quarterly to make sure. So when they made the shift to remote working, it was seamless. Mm-hmm. But now I'm like, wait a minute, they couldn't even support us all working, you know, from home. And so I'm hoping that this will, you know, have employers really looking at the technology and saying, you know what, let's up our game now, because these are questions, because I know I've been interviewing and I asked, so what is the COVID protocol, right? If someone, if you have been around someone who has, you know, been exposed to COVID and you're, you go home for 10 days, what do you do? Like, what do you do? Because if you're new, you don't have sick time required, right? You cannot, you have to work, what, for a year before you can get FMLA, right? So what are we doing?
In between.
You know what I mean? Because previously, I remember years ago, it didn't matter, right? You weren't gonna, let's say for like a call center.
And you the call centers are the worst. Like, don't work there if you, you're not, there's gonna be, they're the worst. And they're built, they're designed for you to be a robot, and humans are not robots.
But now it's like, even jobs like that, what are you gonna do? Like, you can't, I mean, it's gonna cost you a ton of money to keep letting people go and then rehiring. But I'm hoping that the upside of the pandemic is that with what we need and the questions and the situations that are going to occur that are beyond your control, that's going to impact everybody, every industry, Someone is exposed to COVID. The CDC protocol is the 10-day quarantine. So I'm hoping that the blessing in all of this is that not only will it help those with learning disabilities, but they will implement this, like, as you said, this universal design so that it's helping everyone. And then folks who have learning differences, it's helping them as well.
And that's a great, that's the thing too, when people are looking at future jobs and things like that, they should ask, what was the response? How did you support your workforce during the pandemic? That's a great question to ask nowadays.
I asked that question, and you know,
That's a great question.
Being a career coach and that being my background and my love, I'm always that interview is definitely always a two-way street with me. I'm revealing information that I did not before. I'm asking those questions, and I'm like, red flag here.
And you don't set yourself up for misery.
Oh my gosh, this has been awesome. Oh my gosh, we talked about so much and you dropped so many gems. We talked about higher education accommodations. We talked about workplace accommodations and accessibility. And I want to point out that term universal design. I do see it used a lot in higher education around the online learning platform. So I just want parents, I want you to, I mean, our show notes are going to be amazing from this episode, but I hope that you really heard us when we said that students aren't requesting what they need in college, and especially for our Black and Brown students, they are not going to the office to seek out services and supports that they need. It's at an alarming
rate. And that we're eligible for and have a right to.
Eligible and have a right to. Did you hear that? Mm. Eligible and have a right to. And then in the workplace, it's different, but it's available. Right. And these are conversations that we need to start having so that employers can do better. We're educating employers and we're educating ourselves, but the pandemic has opened up a wonderful opportunity for businesses to do better. Mm-hmm. Right. And some laws you need to be familiar with are ADA and 504, mm-hmm. Rehabilitation Act. So thank you, Allison. Thank you so much. This has been a ton of information.
Tune in next week, where we'll continue to bring you lived experiences and more unfiltered conversations with experts in the field around all things Black and dyslexic. Make sure you subscribe and follow the Black and Dyslexic podcast, where we educate, empower, and equip Black and underrepresented minorities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is partially funded by Morgan Cares and the Center for Urban Health Disparities Research and Innovation, awarded by the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is sponsored by Dyslexia Advocation Incorporated, a 501c3 charitable organization located in Baltimore City, Maryland, whose mission is to equip parents of children with dyslexia and other language-based learning disabilities with the necessary tools to help their children become successful readers. You can find them on the web at www.soallcanread.org.